Unlock a new era in podcasting with Unfiltered Studios. Ready to break free from the ordinary? Dive into a world where authenticity meets innovation. Our network isn't just about podcasts. It's a revolution. From nostalgia to movies, sports to self-improvement, find your favorite podcast in an array of diverse shows, only at Unfiltered Studios. Join the movement. Subscribe to Unfiltered Studios today and join the podcasting revolution. Unfiltered Studios, where every voice finds its place. Visit unfpod.com today to find your favorite show.
Unfiltered Studios will help you press record.
And hello, movie lovers, and welcome to the show. With me, I have a very special guest with me. I have Jay Brooke with me from the With Jay Brooke Show. Say hello to everyone, Jay.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
You know what, man? It's great to have you back on here. Last time we did this was for Good Will Hunting, and now here we are doing our top five opening scenes in movies. And I've been wanting to do this segment for a while. I had got some inspiration watching some TikTokers and stuff like that, going back and forth on some of their stuff. And I'm like, okay, I'm definitely. I said now's the time to do it because I want to actually do something a little bit differently. So when you look at opening scenes, how do you judge them?
Well, that was the tough part. First of all, this was a lot of fun. Because everybody always looks at endings, right? Everybody always thinks of the end of the movie, but the beginning is so integral. I mean, it sets everything up. So, you know, of course, at first there's the nostalgia factor for me, but some of these that I was looking at were probably, you know, even newer movies and stuff. So I'm like, I can't totally take that into account. And then some of the other things I was like, well, what's like the iconic factor, right? Like what's opening scenes that everybody talks about? So I kind of looked at it that way. And then I just kind of like started going down the rabbit hole. I'm like, you know, setting the scene or setting up, you know, the characters, you know, setting up what type of movie it is and stuff like that. And then at some point I was like, you know what? These are the five I think I like. I just threw them out there because I started to get crazy with it.
Right, because it can be one of those things like, well, what do I put for my top five? What do I do with this one or that one? Right. And I had trouble with my number four. Like, I kept on scribbling it out. I'm like, okay, I don't want to repeat anything that I've done already. I already did top five scenes, best scenes ever already, and I don't want to go ahead and rehash what I did before. But some of those actually still stuck with me for the opening scenes because some of the stuff I actually talked about for opening scenes. So,
yeah.
So I didn't want to repeat myself. And there, by the way, guys, I didn't go paint by the numbers on this either. I decided to go on ahead, do a little bit differently than what most people do and think outside the box a little bit. And yeah, you're right, though, Jay. Some of this is about nostalgia factor. Some of it is about what sticks and what you keep thinking about. Like, for instance, sometimes I happen to think about certain opening scene to a movie or whatever. It just sticks with you. And it's just, and you're thinking about it throughout the day as well. Of like, if you think of a Starbucks, you think of a certain movie. Or if you think about something else, you think of a certain quote from the opening scene of a movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's whatever, you know, it sticks with you. But you know, you don't think about it all the time because you just might enjoy the movie, but it sets the tone. I mean, the opening is integral. It sets everything up. So,
right. It gets you going on what the plot line is, the character setup, the build of the world that they're trying, the rules that they're trying to get you to follow through with this, with the movie and stuff like that too. So yeah, it definitely does. But we're going to go from five to one. So first off, you're going to go on ahead and go off with your number five. And then after that bounces back over to me with my number five. Until we have one complete list done of our top five.
All right, so I'll start with my number five. Some of these are very interchangeable, but I put this at number five. I chose Raiders of the Lost Ark from 1981.
Oh, nice.
And the reason I did that is it's not my favorite Indiana Jones movie, even though I love at least the first three. I like a lot. But I think when... I think probably Temple of Doom, I want to say that's 83, 84. is probably the best one. But when you mention Indiana Jones, I think everybody always thinks about Indiana Jones escaping from the booby trap temple, for lack of a better term, you know, that the huge boulder, it's iconic. But what I kind of like about it is it has really nothing else to do with the movie. Like, you know, it's a MacGuffin, obviously. But it's setting the tone for what the movie's going to be, not necessarily what they're looking for. You know what I mean? Right. So it's setting up who Indiana Jones is, what the story is about, and it's really just an action adventure story and in its heart, right? And it's kind of a fun movie in a lot of ways. And yeah, I just was like, you know, it's kind of cool that to set up the whole series was just this one scene. And I think when everybody thinks about Indiana Jones, they think about that scene.
Exactly. Because here's the thing, even though there's not much dialogue whenever it comes down to Indy taking the statue and then the ball comes down and starts chasing him through the temple, there's not really much dialogue, but you get to know the character because of the fact of his superstitions and the things that he's afraid of, and then the booby traps. And you also know this is also going to be an action adventure, a little bit of comedy mixed in with it. So you actually get the tone right off the bat. Then you also have what the personality is like for the character. And you also know, hey, look, I'm going to be in this 110% because of the fact there's going to be booby traps in this thing. Right. There's going to be an adventure movie. This is going to have comedy in it. This is going to have everything that I want in an Indiana Jones movie. Right. And that's actually hands down one of my favorite opening scenes as well.
Yeah.
It's just that it
just sets the whole series up. That's why I'm like, I have to throw this on here. It sets the whole thing up.
It really does. And it almost made my list. I almost had that movie on my list. I'm like, am I going too generic or am I not going too generic? It pulls on the nostalgia. But, you know, I decided to go a little bit differently with my number five. I decided to go with like a 2001 movie. And that is the movie Swordfish with John Travolta, Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry.
Yeah.
And And this is what I love about it. Okay. So John Travolta is basically talking to us like as the audience. And of course he's the main villain in this. He's the big bad who's the terrorist in this movie. But my favorite thing is he's talking about movies. He's talking about how you're only allowed one F bomb in a movie and you don't see anything in the background. It's all blurred out. And then once he gets on talking to the FBI agents and stuff like that, then you realize, oh shit, this guy is actually the terrorist who's talking to us, and they acting like he's actually smarter than what we are. And the camera follows him out of Starbucks and outside in the streets into that bus that we're going to see later on at the end of the movie. So I love how he talks to Don Cheadle. I love this whole setup of it. It almost feels like a Pulp Fiction movie, but a little bit differently with it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Every single time I see a Starbucks, I automatically think of Swordfish every single time. And I'm always picturing that John Travolta's in the back of the area and you see nothing but coffee grinds in the very back of them advertising their coffee. And he's over there talking to the audience. But that's just me. But yeah, that's what I get from my number five.
That's a good pick and an interesting pick. And I didn't think of that one. And it's been so long since I've seen the movie. But now that I think about it, yeah, there is a little like Tarantino-esque kind of vibe to it. And which is funny because obviously Travolta made his huge comeback because of Tarantino and Pulp Fiction at the time. I mean, he was down. He was pretty down in Hollywood then. I mean, he wasn't doing anything great, but yeah. And then he sustained that run pretty long time because that's 7 years later too.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's a good one, actually.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. So what's your number four, though?
All right. So for this, I actually went. This is, I don't know if everybody would have this, but for me, actually, this would be an interesting one because there's kind of competing stuff. I chose the opening scene of Baby Driver.
Okay.
And
I like that movie.
I really love that movie. But, you know, it just did that scene is done very differently, you know, like that establishes everything you want to do. It establishes the character, that music's going to play a huge role in the movie. It's filmed very fast paced, but it's kind of fun and, you know, all over the place. But I kept kind of going back when I thought of that. It just triggered something about the movie Drive with Ryan Gosling mm-hmm. in 2011. And they're almost like the same type of opening, but like total juxtapositions of each other. Like Drive is very dark and Baby Driver, the colors pop a little bit more. The music in Baby Driver is who's that? John Spencer Blues Explosion, I think, is the starter in that. Whereas Drive is just like, you know, Drive is obviously not going to be a fun movie.
No, it's definitely not fun. But yeah. It keeps you on the edge of your toes, though, too.
Yeah. So it was funny. I almost was like, which one has a better opening scene for like a car chase, like for a movie that's based on a lot of car chases? But they're different. They're not the stereotypical type of movies for that kind of genre. But exactly. I like kind of like that they both focus on the character and kind of tell you something about the character in just very in polar opposite ways. But I went with Baby Driver just because I think the movie's a little more fun for me. Not as Drive can be tough, like to get through by the end. You're like, you know, some of the violence in it and stuff like that. So I had to go with that.
Baby Driver's hands down one of my favorite movies. I remember buying the soundtrack off of iTunes at the time, and I just fell in love with the soundtrack before I even seen the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just something special about Baby Driver, especially the car scenes and stuff like that too. But yeah, that opening scene also sets the tone. You also introduced a baby for the very first time, and he's doing that bank heist. And mm-hmm. I love how he's also mouthing the words, the lyrics and stuff like that too.
Yeah.
And then,
he's cool and collected. He's laser focused. You know what I mean? He's just, it sets him up really well.
I really love bank heist movies. And that's, to me, is like the best heist movie that you can think of, aside from maybe from Ocean's 11 or maybe Transporter, whenever the very first Transporter came out, which is Jason Statham. But Baby Driver definitely sticks with you and is one of my favorites. Tequila, I remember when the song Tequila came on with Jamie Foxx and stuff like that. I really love that. John Bernthal does a fantastic job in it. John Hamm. Come on, you have a great cast.
That cast is amazing. And the cast kind of plays, well, maybe Jamie Foxx, not as much, but like John Hamm is totally different. It's like right after Mad Men, I want to say. He may be like a year or so. So he's not playing like the slick back, totally together, you know, type of person, the type of personality. He's got a different personality. Everybody kind of plays. Kevin Spacey kind of plays that. He has that same quirk when he's evil. I mean, he's great at it, obviously, but.
Exactly.
But it is a great cast. Who's the star of that? Why can't I think of his name?
I know. I you know what? I forgot the name of the actor. Hold on. By Baby Driver.
That's what I'm doing right now.
Hold on, I got you.
Poor. I should have that. I should have that right in front of me.
Ansel Elgort.
Yeah. And he kind of steals a lot of the scenes from those actors.
He really does. For him to be the main star, yeah.
Which really says something. So that was one of my things. And I just loved the movie. So I was like, screw it. I'm putting it on.
I gotcha. So number four, I was playing around with this. I was like, okay, I want The Departed. Then I'm like, no, I don't want The Departed.
The Departed. I like that.
Yeah, The Departed. Yeah, my Boston accent is coming out a little bit when I say The Departed. But then I was like, no, I want to do Back to the Future. Then after that, like, no, I don't want to do Back to the Future. So I decided to go with a gangster movie. I decided to go with Goodfellas.
I knew that was coming. I had that on the list too, and I took it off.
Because here's the thing. It starts off like a horror movie, if you think about it. Because it's pitch black, and you hear something. You're not sure what it is or anything like that. It sounds like Tommy made a run over something, or something like that. The guys are in the back. You have De Niro in the back. You have Tommy in the passenger side. That's right. And Ray is actually, Henry is actually driving the car. And, you know, all of a sudden they open the trunk. I'm like, oh shit, it's Phil. But you don't know that's Phil. You just know that they just got done killing somebody. So next thing you know it, I like how the red light is just flashing on Henry. And because now he has to go get the shovels out of the trunk with this dead body. And I like how it goes back to all my life. I always wanted to be a gangster.
Yep.
And it just has that still frame. Yeah.
That's the line. Yeah. All my life. And I will always remember that. And I've seen Goodfellas, like, let's face it, 100 times at least. Because whenever it's on.
I actually own it on DVD.
Yeah. And then if it's on TV, it's like, I gotta watch this from wherever it is. You know what I mean? It's just, it's one of those movies I can watch it over and over. The Departed is a great movie too, though.
Yeah, The Departed is really good. The thing that I really loved about The Departed, and this might be just like an honorable mention a little bit, but the thing that I love about The Departed was the fact the intro does not start until like 20 minutes in before they roll the credits.
Yeah.
Because it sets the tone for the characters, and I love that cold opening for it because I've never seen that before. In a movie.
Yeah, I've never seen. Yeah, you're right. I don't have much else to add, but yes, that is a great opening.
Because think of it like this. You had Leonardo DiCaprio having his life.
Right.
Well, first it starts off with Matt Damon and his life as a kid getting and meeting Frank Costello for the first time. And then it goes into his adulthood and he's graduating the academy. While that's happening, you have DiCaprio who has his family. That's mafioso kind of family, kind of corrupted. And he's going in to want to be a statey. And he goes in and does that. And it's this cat and mouse game through the whole entire thing. But he goes to prison to act like he's to go undercover as one of Costello's people later on. And I like how we're introduced to these two different worlds at the same time. While DiCaprio is facing jail time and doing all this stuff for undercover work, we have Damon's character who has the life, the life that DiCaprio wanted, but Quentin and the other guy was like, look, you're not going to be a statey. You're just not going to do it. You're going to be paid as a cop, but you're not going to be a cop. You're going to oppose to be undercover, but you're still a cop. Yep. But I definitely liked it.
Yeah. No, that's a good one too.
What do you have for your number three then?
So number three, I went with The Dark Knight, partly because, you know, I obviously, The Dark Knight's a weird movie for me because honestly, I remember the first time I saw it, I liked it. I didn't love it. And then as it went on, I really loved it. But I was always a big Batman guy as a kid, you know, even like from the first from Keaton and all that stuff in the comics. I was a big comic book kid.
Me too. Still am.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things though, you know, Nolan did such a good job of grounding these movies. I mean, there's spectacle and a lot of that stuff that the Joker pulls off would be really tough. But I think the way his character operates with that sense of anarchy and not caring, he probably could pull a lot of stuff off that you wouldn't believe. You know, there's people who can do that and they have that type of recklessness to them. So I like that opening scene. You know, the music is tense. I think it sets everybody up really good. Obviously, it's all the clown masks and stuff like that, but it's like an overcomplicated
heist job,
but you know, he does it does a good job of setting him up. Like he is reckless, but like he's like organized chaos, but it sets up him as a polar opposite to Batman, which is why later on in the movie it's such a great scene, obviously the interrogation scene, because you realize Batman only has fear. Right. I mean, he's obviously very smart, but he uses fear against criminals and he doesn't he misjudges criminals. And Alfred does tell him that, like, maybe you're misjudging him and, you know, not in that type of words. But that scene where he's just punching him at the end, and the Joker's like, "You have nothing. You have nothing." And you could see the fear, mm-hmm. even though he's got the mask. But it sets it up right away, like that he's chaotic, rebellious. You know, he doesn't care about human life, but he's smart on top of that.
Right. And because, right. Like you said, though, with that bank heist job that you mentioned, too, is like, it's to show how smart he is at planning stuff out and then not leaving anyone behind for the money at all and letting him take it all. And then the way he lines up in the bus line, in the school bus line, was perfect. Just planning around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, just as the buses are pulling in, was genius on his level of how he ended up committing that crime. And then I love the grapple shot of the clowns going down to the buildings and stuff like that. It definitely sets the tone. And I love Nolan's vision of the first two films for the Batman franchise at that time. Of course, I love 89 Batman too. But, you know, but this one, I really liked a little bit of the realism that he used with it as well.
89 Batman's just, you know, it's like a comic book, though, right? I mean, it, you know, the scenes, the way the colors, the Acme play, right. Even that first scene, which I looked at, I thought about it, because you get the iconic "I'm Batman,"
right,
and stuff. You know, just the way everything's set up, but that's Tim Burton, right? I mean, everything's like a
spectacle, honestly.
A gross burlesque of like some. You know, even if you look at Edward Scissorhands, it's like a nightmare version of suburbia, you know, and mm-hmm. he was kind of perfect to capture that version of Gotham, where I think Nolan's one of the few who could pull off that really gritty, down to earth type of superhero movie, because those can act almost. You know, if it isn't Batman, they would still work, like just some guy who's a vigilante.
Right. And also, too, you actually bring out a good point, though, too, especially whenever Alfred's like, look, some men just want to see the world burn.
Yeah, that's.
And he didn't realize that up until he's in that interrogation room. And I like how he slams Joker's head on the table. He goes, "You see, you make things kind of blurry."
Yeah. Never start with the head.
Never start with the head.
It's fuzzy, and that to me is like actually one of the great scenes in movies too, just because it's the only way to get them together in that scene properly to talk,
right?
And he just, you know, Batman's used to just owning everybody with his brute strength and force, and he had to figure out a way when he doesn't have that.
Exactly. So I decided to go with Jaws for my number three.
I was close, yeah.
Because Jaws is hands down one of my favorite movies of all time. Aside from The Crow, Batman, and stuff like that, and The Godfather. Jaws is hands down one of my favorite movies. I remember going to the projects across the street from my aunt in Boston. And I would actually go over to our cousin's house. I would always do this every summer, I swear. I would go ahead and grab the Jaws movie on VHS and then go back over to my aunt's house and watch Jaws.
And well, Jaws is like, it still holds up. Yeah. It holds up so well. Like I watched it 2 or 3 years ago with my daughter, because she was old enough and she was interested. And I was like, I get scared sometimes when I go back to watch these movies. Like I'm almost like, I don't want to watch it because it's going to ruin whatever I thought it was.
Right.
And Jaws is one of those movies that didn't do that.
Exactly, man. Like, the very first scene that you see is that girl going out into the ocean. She's swimming. You don't know what's on. It's dark out. Everybody's on the other side of the beach and everything, partying and stuff like that. But she goes on ahead and swims out, and she's on the buoy. And you notice that something is in the water with her, but you don't know what it is. It's that suspense of, like, I thought I was alone, but I'm not alone here. And then you see her hurrying up, going over to where the buoy is. And then all of a sudden she gets dragged down to the water. So then you're like, okay, what the hell is going on here? You know what I mean? If they didn't put Jaws on the poster to show that this is a shark movie, you wouldn't have known what it was about. You'd be like, okay, what the hell happened? What's going on here? That was one thing that I really liked about it, was the fact of the slow pacing of it. That thing, that mysterious thing in the dark that could get you when you actually feel safe at, because you're swimming and you're at nighttime and no one's, and you feel safe.
I think that comes from a time where the lack of special effects quality really helped these movies, right? Like, because to develop the sense of fear and tension that they needed, they didn't have like the cheap trick of just, you know, like a realistic looking shark, or if they did, they had to take it at certain angles. It's such, you know, that's a scary movie. Like that scene that you're talking about is actually frightening to me. Like I feel that tension in the water. I feel my legs in the water.
Right.
And that's... something's going to pass me, or, you know, I'm like, something's going on, but I feel it when I watch that scene.
Exactly. And I know it's spooky season, so I figured put a horror movie on here.
Yeah.
And I think Jaws is actually the perfect horror movie. I actually bought this on 4K. They had like the steelbook, the vault of the Jaws for the steelbook, and I ended up getting that because I'm a huge Jaws fan. But the watching it in 4K is definitely something I definitely recommend people to do whenever they have a chance.
Yeah, you know what I didn't realize about that movie until not too long ago, that it was PG, mm-hmm. and that Spielberg kind of helped create the PG-13 rating system because of that. Because there used to just be PG, not because of Jaws, but Jaws is one of the movies right. that was like...
But just because of the content in it, though.
Right. And but that happened too with Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was PG, and they wanted to make it R. And Gremlins was another one that was PG. And then it's like you see the blender scene, you're like, what?
How did they get it? How did they get in there as a PG movie?
Can I tell you, I bought that for my son when he was like 4 or 5. And my wife goes, is this an appropriate movie for him? I go, you know, I wouldn't have thought so, but it's PG. You know, it has to be fine. We're watching it. It's just like the guy's getting in the microwave.
Right. And then you see all these eggs all over the place too. Yeah,
she's giving me this look like, I'm like, it's PG. I didn't know.
Hey, it's PG. It's not like it's rated R. There's no boobs or anything like that. So I think that will be good here.
I think, you know, didn't he have something to do with that though? Did he produce Gremlins?
Yeah, he produced it. Because if you don't remember, there is like some small callbacks.
Yeah.
And everything too, and the Goonies.
Right. I forgot.
Because at the sheriff's office, he goes, oh, that reminds me of the time when you thought you saw some gremlins running around town or something like that, to that effect.
Yeah. So he was instrumental in the PG-13 rating because
he
said it was kind of ridiculous that, well, it was kind of a killer if it went to R because, you know, it's not bad enough where somebody, you know, 15, 16 can't see this thing. So that's how they came together with that. But I always thought that was an interesting story because there's some movies I watched back then that I didn't realize. I'm like, oh, I thought this was worse. And then I watch it and I'm like, why is this PG?
Right. Because like I ended up watching like Back to School, Rodney Dangerfield. Oh, yeah. And I'm like, there's boobs in this thing. And it's like, I don't know if it was supposed to be rated R or not, but my mom allowed me to watch it. And then she thought it was a good idea to rent Child's Play at age 5 for me and traumatized me because she saw the doll on the front from the on the VHS tape cover. I'm like, thank you for the traumatization. I do appreciate that. But yeah.
Yeah.
So for your number 2, what would you have to go with?
All right, so this is kind of an icon one and also a childhood thing and nostalgia pick. So, but I think it fits. I chose Star Wars Episode 4. I know, like, that's probably, like, a pick a lot of people would have had. But here's the thing. So I grew up, I was a huge Star Wars nerd. I still watch it, not as religiously as I used to or whatever, where I can name, like, you know, I used to be able to name like off planets and stuff like that. Now I'm not as into it, but But that scene, I think just, you know, obviously for the time, 1977, I didn't see it in the movies because I wasn't alive. But I can understand at the time, like watching, first of all, you have the Skrull. The Skrull's iconic in each of those movies. But, you know, but then you have the scene where obviously you have the small ship that has the plans, and then you just have the ship that never ends come on screen. And I think that changed movies a lot, especially at 77. Remember, the 70s were a time of like really gritty, sometimes ugly films, right? I mean, there's a lot of...
Right, because we just mentioned Jaws, which was a 1975 right. movie. You also had Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Right. It's Raging Bull and all those movies, a lot of...
That was 1980 for Raging Bull.
Oh, come on, man. I just...
Prescriptions, copays, lab tests. Even with insurance, healthcare can cost thousands every year. But not for me, because I'm enrolled in VA healthcare. My service was then. My benefits are now. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Missed that. but the 1970s, you know, which I think it reflects a lot of the social problems in America and stuff like that. Like, just a really, you know, gritty, everything was kind of dark as far as the way the movies were filmed. I mean, and then the content obviously was, and there's some great stuff out in the 70s, obviously, I'm not saying.
Right. Like Halloween, you had the very first Halloween that came out.
I love the first Halloween. That's like that's probably my favorite horror movie. I'm not a big horror guy, but loved Halloween.
There's also Taxi Driver in the 1970s, Taxi Rocky Driver. Horror Picture. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Rocky Horror Picture Show. Yeah, there's a lot of them, but that stands out. I think that changed the culture. And then you'll see like everybody starts trying to make sci-fi special effects movies, and not maybe as popular as they did it and as well as they did it, but it opened a door to something. So I chose it, and obviously for, you know, I had the it's a big part of my growing up. And yeah, I just think it's, you know, it's got the, I almost forgot to mention, you know, it's got the, what's it called? The music too. The score.
Oh, yeah. The score for John Williams.
John Williams. Thank you. That's what I was trying to get to. Yeah, no, John Williams score. And that's iconic. You know, how many movies have we seen that? Usually even the new Marvel movies and all these type of movies, the score is, they have these big, almost operatic type of scenes, you know, that swell and build to something, but it's the music that sets that. I mean, that movie just is so different for its time. It's not my favorite one. Empire will always be my favorite. And, just because I always loved the father-son dynamic in Empire and Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi for me. Is that
your favorite?
Yeah. Return of the Jedi is one of my favorite ones. Now, Kip.
Yeah,
Kip is actually Empire Strikes Back all day long.
I'm Empire too. I think that's more because I think that's the best paced movie out of all of them. I think from start to finish, the pacing is really good in that movie, which sounds silly, but you know, sometimes every once in a while you see these movies and they have like a perfect flow to them. And I think that's that one. And obviously I was alive for the reveal, but I think I was like 6 months old, so it doesn't really count. But that iconic reveal is huge. So I always go with that one. And I always feel kind of bad for the kids and stuff because, you know, to them, they grow up with the prequels and it's like, right. Yeah, we already knew that was
set up.
You know what I mean? But I'm like, dude, that's why you can't appreciate it, though. You'll never be able to.
Right. So, and here's the thing. I grew up with the originals as well. And So I guess you would actually have to say maybe the prequels would be my generation of Star Wars.
Yeah.
In a sense, because I was in seventh grade when that came out. But right. At the same time, it's not, because I grew up with the original OG Star Wars.
Yeah.
So I'd be like, okay, this is not as good as it's kind of having like diet soda in a sense. It's like, okay, I like it, but it doesn't have any flavor, but I'll take it.
You know well, what I mean? So that's one of those things that's weird, right? So yeah, I know what you mean, because there's a whole group that grow up right between the two of them. It's kind of like calling somebody a Xennial when they're Gen Z or a Millennial and you don't know where to place them. You're kind of like in that middle.
Right, so either I'm a Gen X or I'm a Millennial, because I'm right there because I was in 85. So it's like...
Right. Right. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. But I also get, you know, it's funny though, every time a new set comes out, like obviously the sequel trilogy, then all of a sudden everybody like loved the prequels. They're like, well, you know, they were good stories.
It wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
Yeah. Right. You know, going back.
Right.
You know,
for me, so. I love the pod racing for the Phantom Menace. And I also like the Darth Maul scene. That's like the only two things I liked.
I will defend Phantom Menace as a... Part of it is, you know, it's very kiddish. But I always say, I'm like, it has Liam Neeson, who I thought was excellent in that. And it has Darth Maul. And it has the, you know, one of the better lightsaber fights. I mean, I just don't like it as much because the emotional attachment for me is to Vader and Luke.
Right.
Right. But if somebody tells me that's a better fight scene, I'm like, yeah, I got to say it probably is. Right. And so I do think the Phantom Menace, that, you know, the problem I have with those movies is they feel like a really good first draft of something. Like he just needed to hand that hand off and then it would have been fine. Like they would have been good movies fleshed out, but didn't happen, you know?
So I decided to go with a movie that I would say maybe the early 2000s, this movie came out and it was ahead of its time. But, you know, it's now, 1999 is where I'm going with it. Ooh. Even though I already talked about another 1999 movie with Star of Echoes with Kevin Bacon. But
that's a great movie, by the way. I haven't gotten listening to that tomorrow, but I saw that, I was like, oh, my God.
I love that movie. That was a lot to cram into for an hour, but it was great to talk about.
Before I let you go, I have to say, though, that movie suffered because it came out the same exact time, pretty much. Within months of another very similar movie, but that similar movie got the all the attention because of its ending.
My pick, right? My pick, The Matrix.
Okay,
Trinity's Escape.
Yeah, I was really close. I decided to not pick it, but I have consideration ones, and that was one of them. I mean, that really is an iconic opener.
Right, because think of it like this, okay? I ended up doing all the reviews for all the Matrix movies leading up to the new Matrix movies before. Same thing I did with all the Batman movies. I reviewed every single Batman movie leading up to the Batman. The thing that I love and appreciate with the first one is the fact that you can watch this movie 7 times and still not understand a damn thing that's happening in this movie until later on it just clicks. But my favorite thing is with Trinity, you see her do all this kick off the wall and roundhouse kick to the police officer. Then she's running down this hall. Then she goes to the telephone booth. Then you see Agent Smith go try to run her over, and she disappears. And you're like, what the hell happened? And then it wakes up with Neo. But yeah, that's our introduction to Neo, our hero, and stuff like that. But I just thought the introduction of laying down the groundwork for the very first Matrix movie was really good, compelling. The special effects were ahead of its time. Everybody was trying to be like the Matrix at that time. For crying out loud, you even had Dracula 2000 trying to be like the Matrix.
Yeah.
And even The One was trying to be like the Matrix.
Yeah. So I was going to say, very similar to, not similar obviously in style, but similar in effect to what the original Star Wars did. It changed something in movies. It changed special effects forever. Once they could do that, it got overused, let's face it, at some point. By 2005, I was like, all right, can we stop with the stop motion and all that kind of stuff, stop and then spin around. But watching that movie, it was it was ridiculous. But that, yeah, that's a great opener. And then, you know, that's one of those weird iconic films where you could watch it for the cerebral, right? You could sit there and try to think about all the philosophical themes going on, or you could just sit there and watch it for the action, right? Like what's going on. That's I think one of the great testaments of that movie is it toes a line between, depending on what mood you're in, you could care or not care.
Right. You can have it on for background noise and everything and just go to sleep and not even care about anything that's going on in the movie.
And that's definitely a tone setter. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's a great pick. Was that number one?
No, that was my number two.
Okay. I just want to make sure. I was like, did we? Okay.
No. But you know what's funny, though, is I remember joking around with this on the episode, right? I was like, I wonder how many times that Lauren Fishburne's character had to tell Trinity that she's going to meet the one and it happens to be the wrong one.
Yeah.
And she has to go through the whole entire deal of, okay, Trinity, I can't. You're going to meet the one. You're going to fall in love with him. That's what you said about the one before the one, before that one. So which one is it? And then every single one of them dies. And then finally it's Neo. Neo, you're the one. You're the one who's going to fall in love with Trinity. You're going to be the one to do this. Yeah. So I was like just having some fun with it. I'm like, I wonder how many people that he actually had to meet up on the streets. Like, you're the one. Red pill or blue pill?
Right? I never really thought about it. Yeah. How many people is just sitting there?
Could you just imagine the kung fu thing was like, okay, I want you to run off this building. And all of a sudden they just die. I'm like, well, I guess he's not the one. But anyways, speaking of the one, what is your number one?
All right. So I'm going to set up. Well, first, you know, I want to ask you a quick question because I had a consideration here and I didn't take it because I don't know if I consider it the opening scene. I was thinking of the Omaha Beach invasion or D-Day and Saving Private Ryan. But is that actually the opening scene or is him in the cemetery or is it all one?
I feel like you can have a separation with that.
Right. Because that's what I thought.
Because to be honest with you, think of it as like a prologue, right? The prologue is him in the cemetery. Chapter one begins with him on Normandy.
Right.
So I would say that would start the whole entire movie.
The Normandy invasion you're talking about. Like a prologue? Yep. All right. So it could have been in there in the top five.
So yeah, anyway. I think that counts. I think that counts as the start of the film.
Okay. I mean, it might have cracked the top five. It wouldn't have been my number one, but it is one of those things where that's a great movie. And that scene, I don't know why I don't want to get too deep into this because it's not even on my top five, but that scene is very, very, you know, it's so compelling. It's so graphic. Like by the time they open up the boats to run out and you see like 10 people get their heads blown off, like I'm in World War II, I'm at Normandy. I'm sitting there thinking, like, am I hiding and pretending I'm dead? What am I doing at this point? Like, it's scary. Like, it, you know, and he's very anti-war. And I think he kind of made that movie to kind of show it, if I remember correctly, Spielberg. But, you know, I could
see. It shows the complexity of war.
Right.
What war can do to somebody.
Right.
And I remember watching that in world history class, right? Mm-hmm. And our teacher's like, look, this is rated R. I want you guys to sign off on the paperwork and everything for your parents. Make sure that your parents get permission to watch this movie. So we watched it and it sets the tone for what we're getting in store for. And like you said, we want to hide from the bullets. It has the adrenaline going because remember, there is one part where one of the guys is actually trying to control his hands from being jittery and everything too.
Right.
And so, yeah, it has that complexity of war, what the cause and effect of war can do to somebody. And also people can die in war while other people are funding the war.
Right.
Stuff.
Yeah. So that for me would be an honorable mention. I had a couple other ones, but so number one, I went with a Tarantino film.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's the one everybody expects that went back and forth. You know, obviously everybody thinks about I think Tarantino maybe with Pulp Fiction and the diner scene which is an amazing opening. And obviously that movie creates almost like a genre in itself that right. everybody tried to mimic the rest of the 90s. I mean, that movie does change stylistically movies in the 90s, dialogue, you know, that mid-budget indie, almost indie type of feel that everybody got away with up until, you know, for like 10 years. But I actually went with Inglourious Bastards.
Oh, I know what you're going with.
Because the scene's like 10 minutes long, the opener. And I think I'll take his word about it, even though he was talking about another scene, which is like ridiculous, that bar scene. But he talks about creating tension and he says, you have to pull the Band-Aid. I mean, I'm sorry, the rubber band. You're pulling a rubber band when you write these scenes and you're trying to get just enough tension, but you don't want the band to snap. You don't want it to break. And that's one of those scenes. I mean, there's just so much to that scene. I mean, it sets everything up. You know, it's a peaceful hillside in France. It's tranquil. It's small dairy farm, which really contrasts nicely to what was probably going on in the cities at that point and what's about to come. You have a French farmer, dairy farmer there. And then Hans Landa comes there, played by Christoph Waltz. And I mean, he creates a character that is, you know, he's so gentlemanly when he comes to the scene in each scene. And he's so scary and he does it there. Like, and that's the setup. Like, he's such a gentleman when he comes there. And he's speaking French to the farmer and it just takes so long. He just sets it up so well. And then eventually, you know, he's menacing. He's polite, but he's menacing is like how I would call it. And when he gets to the point where he's like, do you speak English? Like trying to find a middle ground. And the guy does, you know, something's up because it's just his tone changed. That's where the menacing part comes in. Right. Just that, like, are there there's enemies of the state under the floorboards? Point them out for me. And then it's just like, you know, it's on from there. But the, you know, he has like a, it's crazy. It's like he enjoys the hunt and he's got like a subtle, subtle dominance in his personality.
That's definitely
scary. He's menacing. He's scary, but he's so gentle about it when he's doing it.
Right. Because he's just trying to ease the tension a little bit. And then he adds the tension at the same time.
Yeah.
And I know I talked about this on best opening scenes ever. Best scenes ever. Top five best scenes ever is what I did. And I talked about the scene. But yeah, he does a fantastic job of just being that character of just getting on that under the person's skin.
Yeah.
And making him do what he wants him to do, which is rat out the people from underneath the floorboards.
Yeah.
And it just sets the tone for what we're going to be in store for later on.
Yeah. He's just, you know, it's so three-dimensional, right? So a lot of villains in those types, a lot of times, like, you know, the Nazis are portrayed in a certain light, right? They're just these evil, not too complex type of characters. And he's got a lot of complexity. I mean, I think he's purely evil in the end. Like, you know, the only time I ever see him totally lose it is when he chokes out the actress in that one scene. And that's the only time I see him like really lose his cool, if I remember correctly about it. Or, you know, maybe when Brad Pitt shoots the end, shoots his friend and is about to do his thing. But it's just, you know, he's set up for the whole movie and he steals the whole movie from at least Brad Pitt and whoever else is in it.
Yeah, he does. He definitely does. So let's see here. My number one, I've actually got an old movie. Well, not an old movie, but this is a movie that changed the superhero genre. This is the film that basically made them forget about Batman and Robin and restored us back into the way superhero films should be. And that is Blade.
Because that is an interesting pick, and I thought about Blade.
Let me tell you why I picked it, not just because the opening scene, but also because of the spooky season. But also, if you think about like this, okay, at that time, the studios didn't want to take their chances on superhero movies anymore at that time. So therefore, they went on ahead, they decided to make Blade. They don't even mention the fact that he's even a comic book character. All you know, he's a vampire. He's a daywalker. That's all you know. And then you realize you had the most successful comic book movie ever. And what they did was fantastic with it. Because of the fact now, the studios are like, okay, you know what? People want to see comic book movies, but they want it to be done in the right way. And on the way that they did it before with Joe Schumacher or anything. So that's what, that's why Blade is such an important movie, is because of the fact if it wasn't for Blade, we wouldn't have The Dark Knight. We wouldn't have the MCU. We wouldn't have all this right now. We wouldn't even have Deadpool at this point either if it wasn't for Blade.
No, I agree with you. In fact, I didn't realize it was a comic book. I didn't really read Blade when I was a kid. You know, I was really into like X-Men and all that stuff.
Right.
But it like never dawned on me when it came out. And you're right. They stayed away from that for forever. What year did that come out?
I want to say 98.
98. Okay. August 21st, 98. Okay. And that's Goyer, who would go on to write the Nolan trilogy, or was a big part of that. He wrote them anyway. I mean, that's a fantastic opening scene that really sets
that bloodbath scene up. Rave, like every single time when that rave song comes on, my mind automatically goes to Blade every single time. That whole entire the guy over to this underground club, and you see the sprinkler system go off. It's once Blade winds up doing his shooting and stuff like that. And it's the sprinkler's filled with blood. Then you also have Blade with the blade that he throws and catches it. The fight scene in the very beginning is rock and roll. It's drug, sex, and rock and roll to me.
Yeah.
Because of how great it is. And the fight sequences, like fight choreography, is fantastic in it. You cannot go wrong with this movie at all. Matter of fact, it's now on 4K and I want to pick it up now.
That's one of those movies. See, that's a time though. So the 90s is like one of those, it's by the late 90s too, where they did take a chance on like these. The 90s is just a crazy run in the middle of it. That they might not have done later. I mean, yes, I think you're right. They obviously didn't say anything about it being a comic book movie, which is funny because now everything's stamped with that.
Right.
I don't know if it'd be interesting, because obviously Marvel's trying to incorporate that. And it was nice to see him get a little bit of a send off in the Deadpool Wolverine movie.
Right. But I also like how Wesley Snipes goes, there's only been one Blade, and there always will be only one Blade. It's like he put a curse on the film itself and be like, you know what? This is actually Wesley's movie. But I do have, in case anybody from Marvel or Disney wants to reach out to me, I have an idea on how you should do this reboot. Have Wesley as Wessler training the new Blade. That way you can still have Wesley in there as a Wessler character, giving the reins over to somebody else.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you have the multiverse, you might as well use it, right?
Exactly. Which I'm tired of the multiverse thing. But this kind of setup, you know what I mean.
I thought it would be better, too. I thought the setups would be much better. And it started off, well, besides, like, Black Widow was weird because that was the start of that phase. And then I was like, why? What was the point of this? I thought it would tie into something, but it was like,
no, oh, it was just his own separate movie that didn't tie into anything.
It was like, oh, we forgot. We should have probably made a movie for Black Widow. So let's just
even
do
though
that
she now. Died.
Yeah. That. So I was like, oh, cool. This will tie into something that starts, kicks this thing off. By the end, I was really disappointed. But, you know, they had Spider-Man and stuff like
that. Yeah, that's what kicked it off was the last Spider-Man movie with the multiverse and stuff.
Yeah.
But still, after that, the biggest mistake was the fact that, number one, they got rid of Tony Stark. That was their home run and lightning in the bottle. Then now I'm hearing, now get this, there's actually a new, and now this is a little separate thing I'm going to talk about real quick and we'll end it. But I also found out too that this is actually like a Marvel is doing their greatest hits album, because now they want to go ahead and get Thanos back again.
I read something about that.
This is a rumor right now. And then they also have RDJ, of course, returning as Doom in this.
So weird.
It is going to be weird. But if they can actually make him a villain and make it work, it could work. But here's the thing. Putting Thanos back in this again, all they're doing, they're in desperate need of help right now. And they know that they, from a studio standpoint, is like, okay, we're struggling here.
Right.
So let's do what worked before. Let's get RDJ back. Let's go on ahead and get Thanos back again, because he was the big bad in the last one. And let's see what the fuck happens. And what it is. It's just their greatest hits. It's like they're trying to remaster their greatest hits album.
Well, you know, part of the problem with that is that they had this run. Mm-hmm. Listen, they did something nobody else could do. Right, they serialized their movies. They had 23 movies that all tied together, and most of them were really good. Most of them, you know, there was a few that fell flat, but even those were like forgivable in some way, like Thor: The Dark World or whatever. I mean, it didn't.
Yeah, kill. Thor: Love and Thunder. Yeah.
Well, but that was like afterwards. I mean, that again, that was a big one that they flopped on, because they might have looked. People might have looked more fondly going forward if Thor Love and Thunder was actually good. I mean, that was just weird. It was like, what, like it was like they tried to do the last movie and it just didn't work on any level. But
it felt like an SNL, like Thor was, you know what it reminds me of? Okay, you remember what's that? There's an old 80s movie that takes place in high school and in Best Times at Richmond High.
Oh, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah, Fast Times at Richmond High. The main character, Bagoli. That's basically what Thor was that whole entire time, was Bagoli.
Yeah, I actually thought they could have done something cool like an Asgardians of the Galaxy movie, because they worked really well together.
Right.
In the Infinity. Infinity War and then Endgame. So, yeah, I thought that would have been interesting. But listen, they had a really good run of movies. I mean, you can't keep it going forever.
They had almost a decade of nothing but home runs.
I mean, they were critically doing very well, and not even just financially. I mean, the critics, every time they put out a movie, were like, oh, this is great. You know what I mean? It was like,
exactly.
It was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous run. And you just, you know, sometimes you have a good thing and I don't know. I know, studios are never going to let it end, but it almost felt like it should have just ended where they had it.
Right. So that's going to be it as far as our top five best opening scenes in a movie goes. But Jay, man, I appreciate you being on the show and stuff. I mean, seriously, this has been great. We've been trying to do a collab for a while, ever since Good Will Hunting. And this is good that we actually found some groundwork to be able to do something. So.
Yeah, I love this, man. It's been this was a lot of fun. This is the most fun I've had on a podcast in a long time. So yeah, this is great, man. You got to come on my show. I still want to do something on 99 before the year's out, because I looked all of a sudden, I was like, oh man, that's like 25 years ago. It's perfect timing to do that.
You know. So. But you know what, though? We have to do another review again, so that way we can do the strip away the nostalgia, do the nostalgia thing.
Yeah.
Like I do now, because I love doing that. Because we talked about how movies might not have aged well, so I think it's actually perfect to do something like that.
Yeah, I think it's great. There's definitely some movies from that year especially that I'm scared to watch because I'm scared of the nostalgia factor getting ruined.
Right. So. But man, I would love to be on your show, to be honest.
Yeah.
Just let me know. I'll be there.
All right, man. We'll make it happen. Be on.
But do you have anything coming out as far as your show goes or anything like that? Anything, any kind of shout outs or anything?
Yeah. So the name of my show is the With Jay Burke Show. Easiest way to describe it. It's kind of like a variety show that digs deep into topics. Sometimes they're really serious. Sometimes they're lighthearted. I think just because of the time of year it is, it's been a little more serious. So this was definitely needed. But I have one coming out soon with Joe C. from The Story Of, where we both talk about its philosophy, really. It's about existentialism, but it'll be about, you know, the meaning of life. But it's more funny. Like, it's a lot of fun, that one. And then I got a few others on the docket. And, you know, like I said, it's kind of all over the place. But you'll find something you like on it, I think, if you look through the catalog. And like I said, I got to have you on. So we're going to make that happen.
Okay, sounds great. But guys, that's going to be it as far as this show goes. Go on ahead and check out our Unfiltered Studios family over there. Jay's part of it. We also have That Florida Feeling. We also have the Stupid History Minutes, Levy G Show. We have Hypno Wellness and also Pedals of Support. We have a lot of interesting podcasts and stuff like that too. So go in and check them out. Also, Finding Your Way with the Beep as well is also another great podcast as well. Mm-hmm. Rossi and I will be doing our Penguin review tomorrow for episode 6 at 8 o'clock Central Time, 9 o'clock Eastern Time for that one. And I've been also working on Rossi's Clubhouse, which is also part of the Unfiltered Studios family as well. So go in and check out Rossi's podcast. And that's going to be it, guys. I hope everyone has a great and safe night, and we'll catch you guys back on the next one. And thank you again, Jay, for joining me. I do appreciate it, as always.
Anytime.
All right. And we are out. Later, guys. Bye.